Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes. Donny Buchanan, welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks, Owen. It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, mate, this has been a long time coming. I'm stoked to have you with us. If you do hear any construction noises, that's because we just happen to be in an office and next door there is
been fun already.
Yeah, so we'll try and do our best to get rid of that. But mate, let's start off with some icebreakers. These are a bit of tongue-in-cheek.
Sure.
Hard questions. So the first one is, are you more fascinated by the collapse of growth stocks in 2022 or the levitation of the Pro Medicus share price?
This is a fun one. Thanks, Owen. What a way to open. Look, we've been long-term shareholders in Pro Medicus, as you probably know, and have sold plenty over the years. It does trade on pretty fundamentally expensive multiples, but we still hold a bit of a stake in the portfolio. So I appreciate that it hasn't crumbled like some of the other growth stocks out there, because it is an extremely high-quality business and deserves a premium multiple.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a longer separate debate that we can have on that. I guess it's probably more fascinating the speed with which growth stocks have moved over the last sort of 9 to 12 months. And I think it's created an interesting opportunity for investors now. And it's times like these when, some of those sentiment readings are flashing extreme fear. I think it's a good time to be leaning in. So given that's what I do day to day, I'll say that I'm more fascinated by that.
Yeah, sure. And did you just, I chose fascinated, right?
Yeah, it wasn't lost on me.
Yeah, okay.
Well played.
Yeah, okay. And the second one is in terms of fascinations. Did you watch the series Byron Bays?
No. It was very controversial up where I live and didn't have a lot of support. And I'm not one to follow social media or reality TV shows. So, hasn't been on my agenda and certainly isn't.
Okay, number three. If I gave you the choice of $1 million, but you had to invest in just one thing for 10 years minimum. So you can't change it. You've invested.
Got it.
Yeah. Or $250,000 and you can buy and sell every year and you can diversify it however you like. What would you choose? And what would you choose to own, I guess?
I think it's a pretty simple decision to start with a 4X head start in terms of 250 to a million. So I'll take the million every day of the week. I'd be interested to talk to anyone that would go another way. And I guess, it's well published that the more people trade, it tends to be value destructive by and large. So I guess that's sort of a base rate, but you're also starting at a much higher level. In terms of what I'd buy, I'd probably tick a few boxes in one fell swoop here and buy property up around the Northern Rivers where I live now. You're asking me, I'm talking about my own street a little bit here, but I guess it's a productive asset and also gives you shelter and security, and I value those things. So that's where I go with it.
Cool. We're going to talk more about the farm and agriculture and all that sort of stuff towards the back, as well as Pro Medicus, but Byron Bays will not get another mention from here on out.
Thank you.
Johnny,
how did you get started in investing? We talked off air about, you know, you went to school in Brizzy, lived on a farm. Like, was this as a business and investing part of your DNA, or did you just happen across it through books? Or
yeah, I guess trying to keep this fairly short. Yeah, come from a farming background in far north Queensland, and the eldest son of a farming family. I got allocated a lot of tasks as a cheap and readily available labour source for my parents, and figured out at a pretty young age that I didn't want to be a farmer. And in some pretty foundational years through the teens, I learned a bit about the stock market, and I guess the penny dropped, and it rang pretty loudly that you can build an asset base and earn an income without having to sit on a tractor or apply your physical labor in some way. And that appealed to me. I could see the value of building that and sort of the power of compounding over time off the back of that. And that led to all my decisions around subjects at school and university and so forth. My parents came across a framework called holistic management, and in the 90s, and there were a few consultants that were around that, and there was a lot of talk about off-farm assets, and I got exposed to elements of the share market and investing through that, and it always resonated with me. So I knew that I didn't want to be a farmer. I got a view into these things and, you know, started down that path. And I guess there's been a few dots that have been connected over the years, but yeah, at a foundational level, that's when it really started.
So maybe just to give people context here, where did you grow up?
Between Innisfail and the Atherton Tablelands on a banana, sugarcane and beef cattle property.
Yeah, right. And now you live on a much smaller farm, but yes. Closer to the beach and good part of the world.
Yeah. No, it was a bit isolated for me up there. I was always expected to take over the family farm, and there was a bigger property further west, sort of 50,000 acres, and you could have a substantial business between those properties. But it didn't interest me, and I didn't want to be a farmer, but I've come full circle, as you sort of pointed out, that it's a good lifestyle. And when my wife and I got to a stage where we wanted to raise children, it was important to me to have that as part of it. And I think it offers some good grounding, some good life lessons, and you've sort of got the security of your own water supply and food supply and so forth if the world were to go to pot.
Yep, I like it. And if there's one place, obviously I'm the Victorian, but if there's one place I'd love to live, it'd be up through there. And very, very nice part of the world you're in, mate.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we met through your time at the Motley Fool, which Lakehouse now obviously being owned by the Motley Fool.
Yep.
But we met when you first started at the Motley Fool. That was going back. You started in 2014. But prior to this, you'd done some really interesting things in the finance industry, but then for yourself as well, which we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Can you take us through that journey? You said that studying like finance and accounting subjects were part of kind of school and uni, but then what led you to the Motley Fool? Like, can you take us through that, like the key stories there?
Yeah. I guess there's probably three main things that happened between school and Lakehouse. And I had a couple of years at a university college and sort of played up and decided, hey, it's time to grow up. And I went and got a job at one of the big four accounting firms as an undergraduate while I completed my studies. And that was the first time I'd had regular income. It wasn't very much at the time, but it allowed me to have regular income to invest. I actually took out a margin loan at that time. This is in the early 2000s, and that allowed me to build a more substantial portfolio than I had more quickly. And, you know, I continued to invest and pay that down. And at times when I thought there was a good opportunity, I'd use that to bring forward the timing of some of my purchases and progressively pay it down over time. And I guess that regular income and being in a position where I could really invest and start to dial that up a bit, that was important to me. But it wasn't until the second moment when I moved to Sydney and I was working for Capital Partners as a graduate, I'd completed part of my CFA. I always worked in after the first 2 years of university, I always worked and completed some studies. So sort of transitioning from the uni phase, I went straight into doing CFA, and that was fun. It put a lot of demands on things, but
for sure it does.
Yeah, yeah. You've been through that. It takes a lot of dedication, and you know, some personal sacrifices to your social life and other things. But anyway, I got a really good investing grounding at Capital Partners. There were some, the business had just transitioned from being an independent research provider to being a fund manager.
Oh, and right. I didn't know that. Okay.
It was a really interesting stage of the business's life. There were a lot of highly intelligent, energetic people that were passionate about investing. Many of them have gone on to do great things. Gerald Stack actually recruited me. He's been at Magellan and was one of the early employees at Magellan and sort of heads up their infrastructure side of the business. Dave Prescott went on to set up Lenion. A couple of the guys are portfolio managers at Platinum. Milford Cooper's just spread throughout the industry. But there was a really good group of people there, and we used to catch up socially quite a lot, and just a lot of talk about investing and getting a great foundation in investing and valuation whilst there. And they straddled public and private markets. So that gave me a very good grounding in terms of doing due diligence on private deals, and you could apply that to public markets as well. So then into the third phase, where I actually left the finance industry for a while in terms of being employed by someone else. I just married my wife. She had a good job, and you know, we had a stable income there, had built up a bit of an asset base, and it was a good time in our lives to take a bit of additional risk. And I made some private investments. So looked at about 60 or 70 opportunities, invested in three businesses. One of them I still own today. And we also bought the farm around that time and have done a fair bit of development around that. And there have been some other private investments along the way, but that was a point in my life where I made a pretty deliberate decision to go and spend time doing that. I always had a, you know, focused a little bit more on private investments, but always had a foot in listed markets as well. I have always had a listed portfolio. And I guess during that time, I stumbled across The Motley Fool, and I was looking for some extra idea generation for the listed portfolio and signed up to one of their newsletters. Long story short, they advertised for a role. We were living up on the farm at that stage, and I threw my hat in the ring because I thought I could help out as an analyst in that business, and I wanted to lean into it and listed markets again a bit more, and you know, could see an opportunity to get paid for it. So long story short, ended up at The Motley Fool and convinced some people that because my background was in funds management, I convinced some people that funds management was a good idea, and we ended up with Lakehouse in 2016.
I might just loop back on something that you mentioned there, which was the private investments. You said you looked at 70. You just come from a place where, you, like you said, you straddled public and private. How did you find those deals for you personally? Like, was it through networks or what?
Yeah, so we were still, good question. And I think that's one of the challenges of private investments is the deal flow and getting access to good deal flow. So we were living in Sydney at the time, and I imagine it's similar in Melbourne, but there are enough networks and events, whether it's a big four accounting firm that runs some of these events and essentially pre-IPO or earlier. Angel Investment Network was, I haven't followed where it's up to today, but it was in a good place back then. Once you start looking for these things and having conversations with people, it just feeds on itself. And there is enough deal flow out there. And I suspect in an environment like this where money has dried up, you can probably find some higher quality ideas now than when money was free and, you know, there were some businesses that were getting support that perhaps shouldn't have.
So you're at The Motley Fool, Donny. You want to kind of light the spark to move into funds management.
Yeah.
And we've had Joe on the show. A lot of people know Joe for many reasons. So the two of you inside The Motley Fool, why did, in your opinion, and what did you see at the time that made Lakehouse make sense?
So the newsletter business is very much DIY. So it requires people to actively do something. They get ideas put to them, but it's up to them to buy or sell or, you know, build and manage a portfolio around those ideas. I could see that a lot of people liked what we did, knew and sort of trusted the philosophy, the investment philosophy and process that had been built around it. And people have big life events and, you know, can become more time poor. Anyway, look, it was just a matter of offering people a do-it-for-me option. And it's not about these things being mutually exclusive. I know plenty of people who invest themselves and also invest in a managed fund, and it was just a good opportunity. It took a little bit of work to convince people within the firm. So as you know, there was a sister business in the US, and it had a didn't have the smoothest start to life, and it made it a little bit harder to convince people. But at the end of the day, there was an opportunity there, and there was a good way to align ourselves with our investors in terms of putting money behind and sharing in the outcomes that we were generating for investors.
You started with the small companies fund, right?
Yeah.
I remember in the early days, and I'm sorry to bring this up, but Bellamy's went into like multiple months of suspension, was it, over Christmas or something?
Yeah, that was pretty fun. There's a good walk down memory lane here. I appreciate it. Yeah, not long after launching the fund, Bellamy's announced that they had a bit of an inventory overhang, and that translated into a cash flow problem for the business. And it was a tough time. It materially impacted the performance of the fund at the time. We were fairly new to it, and what was a listed asset effectively started became an unlisted asset. And just the valuation around that and trying to mark to market, you've still got people transacting on a weekly basis on the unit prices, and you need to make sure you've been equitable to all investors across time. So there was a little bit to figure out on that front, and we worked with our RE and it was a 5% or sub 5% position. So we're not talking about half the portfolio, but it was material enough that we needed to work through that. And yeah, it was, these challenges come up from time to time. The world changes often, and that was an experience that we had pretty early in the life of Lake House. And yeah, we came through it. It was a good lesson for us in hindsight. Yeah,
the growth of Lake House has been it's incredible since that time, and I think a lot of people are caught off guard by how fast you've grown, how well you've done it from a newsletter background, which in some instances hasn't been nearly as successful.
If you can speak sensibly to investors and it resonates with them and you build trust, like ultimately that's what so much of our industry comes down to. I think there's a huge amount of value in a business like yours or the Motley Fool, where you've got a large retail audience.
So Donny, one of the things that's really interesting when people observe Lake House from a distance is the fascinations. And so that's where this ties back into the first little icebreaker we did, which is structuring the business and the investment approach around fascinations. And I'm curious why you did this as opposed to, say, like forming it around sectors, geographies, business, other like types of businesses in different ways. Like, why is it fascinations?
Yeah, I guess you need to. The investable universe is very large, and you need to narrow it down somehow. And there are some fairly conventional ways to do that. Lake House decided to go down a path of fascinations, and it's really just about economic models that stand out. Not all businesses are created equal, and I guess that's something that resonates strongly with me and the team at Lake House. And then you need to think about, well, how do we narrow our focus, and where do we want to narrow that focus? And those economic models of network effects, IP, and extremely loyal customers, they're great places to compound wealth over the long term. And it was just a natural place to be. And we've got leads for each of the fascinations, and these aren't mutually exclusive. Like if you picture a Venn diagram, you might have a fascination and isolation for a business, or there might be two that overlap or three that overlap, and the overlap varies and, you know, different businesses. But at the core, those economic models are what matter and what we think will drive outsized returns over time. So Erwin Tan leads our networks fascination. Kenny Mai, our loyalty fascination, and Abby Malin, the IP fascination. And people can build up expert subject matter expertise within those verticals. They're not isolated to them, but it helps you turn over rocks with a higher velocity as people become, you know, more familiar with that. A good example is, say, Nick Thompson, who now manages the Global Fund. He used to be the lead on the loyalty fascination and has built up a great database of standardizing LTV to CAC calculations for enterprise software businesses domestically, but across the globe as well. And that's been a really useful resource, and it helps us cut to the chase a lot quicker to understand where businesses are at, where they sit relative to their peers in a very consistent way. So that's an example of how it allows us to move faster and have that subject matter expertise within a certain area. So it's helpful.
Does it so like you've got extreme customer loyalty, you got IP, et cetera. Do you find that you're biased towards companies over time when you look at the composition of the portfolio?
Certainly biased towards certain sectors
software, for example. You mentioned ERP. I imagine SaaS companies are in there because they're highly recurring in nature. They've got wide margins, et cetera.
Yep. Yeah. So you do gravitate towards certain sectors as they're defined by the market. There's been some funny examples of companies being bounced from technology to communication sector or whatever. You know, we don't pay too much attention to what sector they're in, but we understand that the market does, and people like to bucket things. But yeah, we tend to cluster around technology, consumer, and healthcare.
Mm. I know we had breakfast one day many years ago in Hawthorne, actually, down in Melbourne, and I think you may have, I don't know if you were in town to speak with the guys at ProMedicus, but you may have been. I can't remember. I don't know if you remember, but I know that
I do remember.
You followed that business for a long time, like you personally as well. And we talk about it a bit on the show because it actually has been the best performing company on the stock market over 10 years. It's like ProMedicus, Daylight, and there's Altium and a few other businesses that sit underneath that. And I'm hoping you can maybe, first of all, just for anyone that doesn't know what this business does, just tell us what they do. But then how you went about understanding the business and what caught your attention?
Yeah, I guess it was one that was familiar through the Motley Fool days, and there's a bit of history that precedes this. And shout out to Claude. Claude was probably the first person that ever raised the company with me, and I know it's been good to him. So well done, Claude. So we did meet with Sam and Clayton in their Richmond office in about August 2016. So it predates the fund by a little bit. It was one of the first investments that we made. But getting back to your question, what does the business do? In very simple terms, it's sort of healthcare software. But more specifically, they provide practice. The historical business, or the sort of the original format, was practice management software for radiologists. And the real turning point for that business came in 2009 when, in the aftermath of the GFC, Sam made what I think was one of the best transactions that I know of in the Australian market, and purchased the streaming software that Visage 7 is built off out of Germany. And that has been built into what is the beating heart of ProMedicus today. And I guess the real feature around that is the speed, functionality, scalability of that. And it really comes down to streaming versus downloading. And you've had a situation in the radiology industry, and just, you know, elsewhere as well, where file size has exploded. So you've had digital cameras come in and replace sort of lead-based film and that sort of thing. And file size absolutely exploded. And the importance of being able to move large files around efficiently, being able to manipulate them has become increasingly important. And that's really been the heart of Visage's edge in building out the market position that they have today. There's a lot of optionality that hangs off that as well, sort of, they've been working for a long time on going into cardiology and other ologies and basically using the same base technology to be able to look at large, large valuable images and manipulate them offsite. So a big theme over the last couple of years has been healthcare companies. For the longest time, patient data was seen as really, really sensitive, and it is. And the approach from the industry was, we need to keep this on premise. Like, we need to have a guard with a lock and key, keeping this secure. And there was, they weren't interested in looking at the cloud. Anyway, fast forward a few years, and there has been a strong adoption in cloud software by the healthcare industry. And as those barriers have come down, it has further advantaged Pro Medicus. It is just a very thin software stack that can facilitate a radiologist working from their garage on the other side of the world, looking at images for half a dozen or a dozen hospitals. And that scalability and the adoption of cloud has really helped it to accelerate its growth to a point where most of the RFPs today, you need to tick the box on cloud. And Pro Medicus is very well placed, and I look forward to them moving into other ologies and so forth in time. And, they've got their PAC system as well, so allowing hospitals to move even more images onto their platform and stream it in the same way. So that was a long and winding answer to explaining what the business does.
Yeah, no. I like it, mate. But so one of the criticisms, right, of Pro Medicus in those days was, this company, I think at the time, was spending like $2 million in R&D or $3 million. It was tiny, whatever it was, right? And then people are like, well, how can that compete against Fujifilm, and how can it compete against blah, 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 blah? And if you're looking at a business like that, what are some of the, factors that made you get comfortable building a position in that? Like you said, you met with Sam and Clayton. What was it about them, maybe? Did you go to any radiology clinics or conferences, or how did you get comfortable with that business?
Yeah, I guess we're very much attracted to founder-led businesses. And in my time investing, not all businesses are created equal, and not all founders are created equal. And I'm developing a better nose for which founders I want to align with, and those which you need to be a little bit more careful about. And what it really comes down to is sort of a little bit of ego and the promotional effort that they put into their business. And you need to accept some of that, because these businesses need capital, right? But anyway, Sam was just very open, honest, and trustworthy from day one. He is one that always... he's very conscious of what expectations he sets in the market, and never really gives guidance, is very vague about pipeline, doesn't set expectations that can trip him up, and he's just got a long-term focus on what he's doing. He's deeply passionate about it. That shone through from the very first time that we spoke to him, and it was just easy to build some trust and alignment around what he was doing. And there were some capital allocation decisions before we owned the business. So he conducted a buyback pretty early on in the business, and we ran the numbers on that. And I can't recall the numbers off the top of my head, but it was hugely value creative. We bought into the business at the end of 2016 when we launched the fund, and they conducted another buyback thereafter. It might have been December of that year into the start of the year. He's just got a really good track record of capital allocation around his share buybacks. Made that masterful deal in buying the core technology in 2009. I think he's setting himself up for that again. Now he's got an arsenal of cash, and has bought back some shares throughout this year, but has certainly built a decent arsenal. And I think some of the AI technology that's built, the ecosystem that's sort of built around some of their imagery, there's a good chance it throws up some opportunities for him. So really about trust, understanding his track record of capital allocation, warming to that, and you sort of incrementally build up your knowledge over time and that relationship. And yeah, there hasn't been anything that's chipped away at it over time.
Yeah, I don't want to make a show about Pro Medicus today. Neither of us want to do that. But I think it just serves to illustrate how you think about businesses in general, and it's a company that a lot of people can relate to.
I think a lot of it comes down to what we. There are many computer programs and a lot of smart people in our industry, and the quantitative analysis is a well-worn path. Something that we try to focus more on, and we're still putting increasingly more effort behind it, is the qualitative side and understanding the cultural aspects of businesses and the mindset of the leaders and capital allocators around those businesses that allow them to thrive over time. If you've got an operator there that has a short-term mindset and you know that, then it's probably not somewhere you want to place capital, and it's less likely to compound well over time. That's part of the reason why, you know, founders tend to be good places to align capital. I think there's a study that Morgan Stanley did a number of years ago, and they probably update it fairly frequently, but you're talking about in the order of 3% a year outperformance of family-owned businesses or founder-led businesses outperforming, and, you know, rule of 72, every 25 years you're sort of more than doubling, or less than that, you're more than doubling your investment returns from that incremental 3%. And, you know, we're relatively young guys. I'll take that every day of the week if I can get that sort of advantage over that period of time. So these people, as in founders or family-led businesses, this is their legacy to the world, and they care deeply, more deeply than a salaried CEO, about their businesses. And if you can find the right ones that have a long-term mindset, the data says more often than not that that'll work out well for you, better than buying collectively all of the businesses in a passive fund, for example.
Yep. The question that often gets brought up when people get to know Lakehouse, whether it's the global fund or the small companies soft closed, by the way, is it?
It has soft closed. We always said that we'd close that as capacity approached 500 million. We, you know, myself and my friends and family have money in that fund, and we've got no interest in sacrificing performance for being large. So we did soft close that in February of 2021, I believe it was, if I remember rightly. And just with the market pulling back, it's opened up some capacity. So it's open again. Okay. I look forward to the day where we get to soft close it again, though, Owen.
Yeah, okay. That's a problem that happens with a lot of particularly small cap fund managers, is the best ones fill up really quickly, right? Because you can't just keep going forever. But one of the things that people observe when they look at the website or they just read your updates is the portfolios are very concentrated.
Yeah, they are.
And in particular, the top five positions. Why did you decide to go down that path, and why is that optimal for what you offer?
Yeah, I guess that was always... So when Joe and I set up the business, we were a small team. We were two people for a long stretch of time, and you need to have focus. The fascinations helps go down that path a good bit. But also, it doesn't make a lot of sense to own your 31st, 41st, 51st best idea. And, you know, various studies point to the fact that investment managers make their best returns out of their highest conviction positions. So lean into that. And I think beyond that, I think that the market is really separating. If you're an index-hugging active manager, I think that they're much more exposed, much more vulnerable, much more, you know, at risk these days than in the past. And I see a lot more asset allocators, financial planners going to a bit more of a barbell strategy that is, okay, let's get our market beta risk out of a very low-cost index product. And you do a great job of helping facilitate that for people. But then if you want to something that's a little bit higher octane that can generate some outperformance, I think going to managers that have high active share, high active share like we do at Lakehouse, I think that makes a lot of sense. you know, the investment philosophy and process needs to resonate with investors because of the concentrated nature. You can have some pretty big moves, and you know, we've certainly experienced that over the last 12 months with the heavy sell-off in growth stocks. That's par for the course in investing, but I still believe very deeply that it is a great way to compound wealth over the long term, and this is a long-term game that we're in, and yeah, we're still early in that innings.
Yeah, I like it. So this brings, I guess, when people see that, for what it's worth, I agree completely. I think when we talk about on the show, we talk about risk budget. We also talk about fee budgets. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, if you're building a portfolio, so you can have your passive core portfolio, then where you take those bets, you want them to be the right bets, and you're willing to pay for it typically, like if they're good managers, right? But when people think about concentration in particular, they think about downside as well,
mm-hmm.
right? So how do you know when you're wrong on a company, I guess? Is there like a checklist or some way you think about that? I don't know, maybe if you use an example, if you have one, but I'm just putting you on the spot here, sorry.
Mm-hmm. That's all right.
Yeah. How do you know when you're wrong, and how do you protect that downside?
Yeah, I'd say it's one of the challenges and something that I've reflected on a lot over the last 12 months. A challenge with our investing philosophy and style of being long-term, being patient, trying to filter out the noise, is that you're less reactionary. And we have been guilty of thesis creep in the past. And it's something that we're much more attuned to these days. And this is, you know, this is something that came to the fore in the first year of running Lakehouse, and the second and third, it sort of incrementally been built, and you sort of recognize it more over time and try to tweak your processes to pick that up more quickly. So yeah, it's a balance of acknowledging that, hey, this 6-monthly result, yeah, it might be noise, short-term noise within a long-term thesis, but hey, there's enough here that it's dented our conviction. We need to take some chips off the table here. To completely exit a position, the price needs to be at extraordinary levels that we can't justify the valuation, even at, you know, at a higher end. We don't like selling on price alone, but the most common way is a thesis breaks, and things move pretty quickly in smalls land. And it's happened a few times where a thesis breaks, a bad capital allocation decision is made by a management team that you don't support or don't have confidence in. And, you know, we tend to want to be there for the long term, but you need to balance that with the world's a very dynamic place, and you need to adjust and adapt to what's happening out there, and try to do it as quickly and efficiently as you can. So.
Mm. Yeah, I remember one of those, I think it was one of those positions, was RPM Global at the time. I think they sold their GeoGas, and you guys voiced concerns about like that capital allocation decision. But while we're on this topic, I think this is really valuable because it plays a big role in what you think about is, and this is a bit of a cheeky one, but it's who, as you've done this for quite a few years now, who is the best capital allocator you've come across? Maybe if you wanted to take that at the CEO or at the investor level, who have you come across and been really impressed by?
Well, as I touched on before, I think Sam's transaction in 2009 is one of the best that I've seen. And he's got a great track record on his share buybacks. Tony Wall, Objective Corporation, it's a business that we used to own. And Tony similarly has a great capital allocation track record if you go and have a look at his buybacks. And I guess in terms of it happening at scale, so Mark Leonard at Constellation Software on the global fund side, it's a holding there. It's one that Nick has covered for a long time. Kenny Mai covers it now. It has Constellation really, what's the word I'm looking for here? Sort of institutionalized capital allocation and slightly different model to Berkshire. So Berkshire sort of concentrates the capital allocation decisions in head office, whereas Constellation sort of pushes it down. But that framework has delivered, I don't know the latest numbers, but well north of 20% compound per annum since inception. buying vertical software businesses across the globe. And for someone to be able to build such a large and sustaining business off a capital allocation model, it's a hard one to ignore. And, you know, I think there's a good bit that can be learned from that. It's harder in the Australian smalls landscape. Businesses tend to be much earlier in their life cycle, and you don't have the same longevity as, you know, a standout like a Berkshire, a Constellation, or such. So,
yeah, it's Mark Leonard did this interview once, and it was like, I don't know if you ever come across it. It was on Twitter for a while, and I think it's since been taken down. But it was for one of the business units.
Mm-hmm.
They had a podcast, and he appeared on it, and because he's typically very shy.
Yes.
Like, he doesn't really make a scene or anything. And I remember just dialing into that. I've since lost it, and I'm devastated. Kevin Fung, if you're listening, thanks for sharing it. But, it's just, like, unbelievable. Those letters are fantastic. It's a masterclass in capital allocation too. So, couldn't agree with you more there, mate.
This is no insight here, but you know, Jeff Bezos and what he's done, and the whole mentality of failing quickly, and the capital allocation track record that he's built around that business, and trying different things, and recognizing when you're wrong quickly. I think there are plenty of examples the world over, but yeah, there's a couple on the global side there for you.
Mm. Yeah, so many great companies in that list. There was actually one company, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, that I couldn't remember the name of in the Global Fund. It was the second position, and I was like, oh, I've never heard of this business. So it's one, if you're looking for more of Donnie's or the team's insights, please head to the Lakehouse website and just read the letters. It's just awesome. So, mate, a bit of a fun one is if you could take one investor, they could be an investor, they could be like an author that you read or whoever, and one CEO or founder or whatever to dinner at the same time. Well, actually, I said dinner, but I was thinking if it's Donnie, it's probably maybe a Potter Palmer, or maybe just like, you know, I don't know, whatever you do.
Any of that works. Yeah,
yeah. Sure. Yeah. If you could take them somewhere and just sit down with them and talk to them for a while, who would they be?
Yeah, I guess on the investor side, I own an excavator. I only want older people to operate it. They've made all the mistakes in their life, and they're going to be gentle and mindful of their own safety in operating the machine. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that approach in life and investing. So, you know, there's the obvious ones, the Mungers of the world. I love how to the point and almost politically incorrect that he can be. You know, Warren's very folksy and all that sort of thing, but he's got an immense amount of investing experience, and you can learn from the mistakes and things that they've seen. But I guess trying to pick someone that this isn't really off-piste, but I read the Seth Klarman's Margin of Safety back in the Capital Partners days, and it was profoundly sensible, and I'm probably overdue to go and read it again, to be honest. He invested differently to what I've gravitated towards in terms of the growth investing at Lakehouse, but someone else that's fairly media shy, but I think just has a different way of thinking and is a very deep thinker, and I think it would be an engaging and very insightful dinner conversation or pot and palmy conversation with Seth.
Did you say palmy? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a Queensland thing?
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, I think it's pronounced Palmer.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
I'll work on that.
Like, you know, the AFL is the sport.
Yeah, not so much. with roots in far north Queensland, I'm deeply a league supporter, mate, and Queenslander at that.
Yeah, no doubt, mate. Okay. So your upbringing on a farm, now living on a farm, I think people, like, I love chatting to you because you just bring this down to earth nature to the way you think about life and investing and everything like this, mate. So it's a real treat. But I remember you wrote an article. This was a long time ago, and I can't remember the company. It was for the Motley Fool site. It may have been Rural Funds Group or one of the businesses that was listed.
I think I know the article you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you made a comment in there that, in your experience, typically the best farms and the best agricultural assets are intergenerational, and so it makes it quite difficult to make a lot of money in the public sphere in that way. Is that a fair, do you think that's a fair assessment? Like, you know, I don't even know if I got that right, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was something in there along those lines. I guess my familiarity with agriculture and, you know, there are many different parts to agriculture, but they're often 24/7 type businesses, and it's hard for a corporate to compete with a family operator in that sense. The family operated businesses, it's an extension of them, who they are as people and what they do. And I think that they just have a fundamental advantage in a what I think is frankly a difficult industry. So we have a question on our checklist at Lakehouse that is, what are the uncontrollable externalities that could sink the business? And when I think about agriculture, there are a few there. So typically most agricultural businesses are price takers, and that can be in an environment where you're competing against producers that are heavily subsidized or supported in some way by their governments. You know, if you think of global wheat prices, global milk prices, insert other soft commodity. And then also, and perhaps the biggest one, is you're beholden to weather in a lot of cases. And that creates a lot more volatility in the cash flow of the businesses. And I don't think it's an industry that's well suited to high levels of debt. But there are periods of time where that happens. And if you're in an industry where you can have a couple of great years and then a couple of doozies, you know, we had a 4 or 5 year drought in parts of New South Wales and Queensland not that long ago. If you're subject to those sort of uncontrollable externalities, then you need to have your capital structure right and not be exposed when the tide inevitably goes out on the weather front. And yeah, I guess there were some foundational lessons there for me growing bananas. I remember picking bananas one Christmas after Cyclone Joy came through and just wiped out the crop, and you can harvest what's there for a couple of days, but your income's gone for the next 12 months from that. And it's a tough place to be. And similarly for cattle or sugarcane, I think it was 1995 the industry got deregulated, so the comfortable pricing that farmers were used to then, that got taken away. Similar thing happened in the milk industry. And yeah, it's a tough place to be. I have a lot of respect for people that do it, and there are many people that do it well. But like I said, it's really those farming families that stand out. And there's been a trend towards, we're going down a bit of a rabbit hole here. There's been a trend towards agricultural investment by insurance and pension funds and in recent years. I'll be interested to see how that plays out. There used to be a good bit of that. So AMP, in its heyday, it owned Stanbroke Pastoral Company, one of the largest land holdings in Australia at the time. Things sort of came full circle there. And, you know, it's interesting seeing some of the liquidity challenges around at the moment and the push towards unlisted assets generally. I'm interested to see how all of that works out. Uncorrelated returns and all of that. I understand the concept behind it and the attraction to it.
I hope the actuaries figured out that once listed products fall, that means that the bigger part of your pie is unlisted and you can't liquidate of unlisted.
It's an interesting time. It sort of reminds me of during the GFC or in the shadows of the GFC when APRA was writing to the big pension funds and asking them to, you know, quite often a lot of the best performing ones had the best returns because you don't need to mark them to market as often. And the valuation can be independent, but a managed process.
Mm-hmm.
That's a conversation for a pot and palmy sometime.
Okay. All right. If you had $100 million, mate, how would you spend your day differently?
I know what I'm supposed to say here, Owen, but sorry, Stuart. Look, I love what I do. I love the team that I work with. Lakehouse means a lot to me. I would give the vast majority of that money to Lakehouse to manage. I would want to still be involved. I'm not someone who wants to go and buy an island or a yacht and sit on there and not interact with people. I think that it'd actually be quite boring. I like to be busy. I like to be, you know, involved in things. And Lakehouse would certainly be a big part of that. I'd probably spend more time turning my farm into the estate that I have pictured in my head. I guess walking my kids to school every day and, you know, walking just so that you can slow time down and spend more
quality time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because so. Obviously you live near Byron and your office is here in Sydney. How often do you get down here?
In short, as often as I need to.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID, it was a lot more.
Yeah,
I remember. Sort of every 2 weeks, I'd basically camp down here during reporting season. Used to have to one of the main reasons I came down, besides seeing the team, was for company meetings, and that has completely changed through COVID. So, as you know, a lot of these company meetings have gone online. Zoom and the likes have been a huge boon to being able to live and work remotely. And there's obviously the societal acceptance of it. So I've been living up there almost 11 years, you know, co-founded Lakehouse from there, did my whole time working at the Motley Fool from up there. It's a well-worn path for me, and it's just been a gradual shift over time. And with three kids, seven and under, it's been helpful, being able to spend more time. It's good balance.
I know it would be a lot to come down, but thankfully that's one of the things that's been great coming out of COVID.
Yep.
Fewer flights, less spending at hotels. I'm sorry if you work at a hotel or own one, but it's made life a lot easier, better balance for a lot of folks too. And it's something that we've been accustomed to with the Motley Fool as well, being able to do that. This is more of a personal question, Donnie. It's the second last one I've got for you, which is you've spent a lot of time with private investments, which you mentioned, not only professionally but also privately in your own time. But I'm curious how you think that skew might change over time, because you have been in both camps for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I spoke about recently was the shifting in the mix in markets.
Yep.
Overall.
Yep.
Fewer listed companies.
Yep.
More investment in private companies and scale-ups and staying private, if that makes sense, and how you think that that might affect even the way you invest.
Yeah, look, I always have had a good portion of wealth in listed equities. I think that will always be the case. I enjoy looking at businesses and finding what I think are better businesses than average. I think that we can typically do that well over the long term. So that'll always be part of it. But the private side's always been of interest. I think there's opportunity to get a little bit closer to the music and influence outcomes there. And I enjoy that as well. And I think that'll be a material part of my portfolio going forward. I guess like most things, it's just about balance. And it'll be a balance based on circumstances and stage of life at each of those points.
I think it's really impressive that you've been able to, you know, understand business first and foremost from a very young age, it seems, that I don't know if it's exposure to the family business or what have you, but to be able to understand that a business is a business no matter where you find it, if it's on public markets or in private markets. And even some analysts, I often think, just can't reconcile. Like they're so used to like the statements should look like this. This should be presented to me, and they fail to grasp that this is just a business. Like it's the same as the thing down in the corner shop there, you know, just on a different level. So, and I just obviously being someone who talks a lot about ETFs and that sort of stuff, the implications there could be interesting over the long term.
Yep.
But the hardest question I've got for you, Donnie, is actually the last one.
Right.
Which is, I always think about this question for myself and I think, yeah, I don't know what I'd say. So, I don't know, I'll just try it on with you and then we'll see what happens. But what's one thing you believe about investing, business or just life, that few people would agree with you on?
Okay. I guess I might have a go at answering this in two parts.
Sure.
The first one, people – actually, I'll come back to that. So, something – that I think plenty of people would disagree about, is I think the share market should only be open one day a week. I think that by having markets open as much as they are, it creates a lot of noise, it creates a lot of volatility. And as a society, we end up allocating more what could otherwise be productive human capital to, you know, very smart people work in our industry. I don't know that all of the volatility and the ecosystem that builds around that is necessarily valuable or productive to society, and that could be reallocated in other ways. I think if people had weekly liquidity, that would be sufficient. And I think we could be in a different or better place if we had that sort of focus and allocated some time and resources elsewhere. I'm sure that's controversial. I guess something less controversial and probably underscores this conversation is I believe in building a life that you don't need a vacation from. And that's hopefully that's something that resonates with people and maybe is a bit of a takeaway in terms of finding the balance that they want in their life and what they're doing.
Yeah. I do like to vacation where you live. So
I look forward to your next visit, yeah. Owen.
Mate, this has been a real treat for me because we've known each other for so long. I've never recorded anything with you before, and I think you just have so much to offer. I actually only think we've just scratched the surface here today. If people wanted to find out more about Lakehouse and you, where would they go?
To the website that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah,
There's some great people that work there. Nick Thompson, Erwin Tan, and the rest of the team. If you get an opportunity to read an article by them or meet them in person, I'd encourage you to do that. I think they're fantastic people and fantastic investors. So just reach out to anyone on the team or lean into any articles that we have out there, and
yeah,
you'll learn a bit, I hope.
Yeah, and there's also the webinars. So the webinars are available on the website as well. You guys answer questions, you go through portfolios. It's really good stuff. So if you want, I don't know many funds that do this like so professionally and consistently. So if you do want to learn about more of the businesses that Donnie watches and, you know, researches, just go and check out the Lakehouse Capital website. I'll put a link in the show notes. Donnie, thanks. I don't know if you come down from Byron for this. I hope not. Like, I hope you had more important things than me. But, mate, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me here in Sydney.
Great being here, Owen. And thank you. I hope we get to do it again someday.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcast, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called RASCOR. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 RASC community members have begun the RASC plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by RASC, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASCOR, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax? I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight. Want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds,
or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that, all of that, by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000. And hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask Network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.